from asking any other question you want to talk about. I'm going to be talking a lot about oil and alternative fuels, but if you want to talk about something else, feel free to stick to the topic.
Maybe not midstream. Maybe I'll finish with what's on the slideshow, and then we'll get into whatever else you want to talk about. We've got a huge challenge, seems to me. We are dependent on a region of the world that hates us, that flies planes into our buildings and sort of likes it when 3,000 of our people die in a single day. We're dependent on a finite resource that's that has new customers. And we'll get into that in just a second. You see here the cover of National Geographic about a year and a half ago announced the end of cheap oil. And it's the end of cheap oil because of some supply issues, but I would say it's mostly a demand issue. China is now the number two demander of oil in the world. India is maybe a decade behind them in terms of their growth and development. But as President Bush said the other day, he's just back from India, they have a growth rate of 8%. China has a growth rate of 7%. If you compound those growth rates, you see that it doesn't take many years for the demand for this finite supply of hydrocarbons to get out of control. Of course, the question a lot of people ask is, well, why is oil so expensive? Why is gasoline so expensive? We got an expert right here, but I'm now going to sing the tune. Wilton, you're going to tell me if I'm right here. Wilton will correct this if it's wrong. Where does the money go? Well, 19% goes to taxes. You pay federal and state taxes when you pump gas. 8% goes to distribution and marketing. Refining gets 18%, and 55% of the value is in the crude oil. Does that look about right, Wilton, as far as you can tell?
Very little comes to me.
There we go. We figured you might say that. And actually, that slide shows that. That's the 8% for distribution and marketing. Next slide there, prices, says that the energy threat is substantial because 9 of the last 10 recessions have been associated with some jolt in the price of energy. So what we're talking about here is not just something that affects Wilton's business, it affects every business in the room. If 9 of the last 10 recessions have been associated with a spike in energy prices. Our reliance on Middle Eastern oil is something that, of course, threatens our security, in my opinion. It's also just a little bit ironic that we're funding terrorism. The money that we send by buying their crude oil, some part of it ends up in the hands of some bad folks. So it's not a good deal to have a supplier who really hates you and wants to do you in. It's also true that our reliance on hydrocarbons is creating perhaps some problem with climate change, and we can get into that if you want to. I used to be somewhat of a poo-poo that idea couldn't be happening. Then I became agnostic. Now I'm pretty much a believer that probably something is up, and we should be doing something about it. Now, the main reason we should be doing something about it is the energy security and national security aspects that are immediate, but also we get the long-term benefits of fixing this environmental issue as well. Next thing we've got up here is you can see where the oil comes from in the world. We've got some. We're there at number three. You see Saudi Arabia there is number one, Russia number two. There are other places that have more oil than we do. We get about, we can produce about 40% of what we need. 40% comes from our own sources. 60% we import. And of course, you can see some of the places where we import it from are not too friendly to us. Actually, I think that the next slide will show you that pretty graphically. Of the 60% that we import, you see how much comes from OPEC. We're getting most of that imported oil from OPEC. And that includes people like Chavez and Venezuela. And you see that we are dependent on places like Venezuela, Iran, which, of course, as you know, is threatening that if we take them to the UN Security Council, they will do other things with their oil. Some people, particularly Wall Street Journal, says not to worry. It's a world market in oil. They'll sell it. They'll always sell it. They want to make money. I wish I could believe that. But, you know, I think that Wall Street Journal, it's strange for a Republican to say the Wall Street Journal is missing something, but I think they are flat out missing something. And that is, there's a bottom line below the bottom line. It's what you believe. And it's really more important than the bottom line. And so there are countries of the world who are happy living essentially in the Stone Age. And they're happy for you to return to living in the Stone Age. So it's not so much about money for them. And if we continue in that Wall Street Journal kind of theory that, oh, well, it's all old, it's a world market, and we just, the price will go up and they'll sell it. Are you sure? Are you sure that a Middle Eastern country that has a new fanatic leader decides that there's a deeper bottom line than the bottom line that the Wall Street Journal sees? I think there's a deeper bottom line. So OPEC is where we get our oil. Why can't we rely on oil? Well, there's a line for gas in one of China's provinces. It's a line at a gas station. Picture's worth 1,000 words, isn't it? You have 1.3 billion people with a growth rate of 7%, as I just said. They're now the number two demander of oil in the world. The price of oil is not going down. If anything's going, it's got to go up. You can't have 1.3 billion people growing at 7% annually and not expect them to start driving cars like we do. As they do, well, we'll have more gas lines like that in China. Let's see, next one's price. Common question, what about AMWAR? Alaska National Wildlife Refuge, we have some oil there. We're getting other oil from other places in Alaska. The message that I hope to leave with you today about AMWAR is please don't think it's the solution to our problem. It is a very small supply of oil. In fact, 10 years from now, as you can see down there in the bottom, 10 years from now, that's actually sort of a confusing chart. 10 years from now, AMWAR may produce 1 million barrels a day. May produce. And that's actually me being a little bit generous to the people that are very much for AMWAR drilling. Actually, the administration says it's 800,000 barrels. But let's say it's 1 million, just to keep the numbers round. It's 1 million barrels a day 10 years from now. Well, we're currently using 20 million barrels a day. So if you could fast forward and immediately get the pipeline here by some magic, it'd be 1/20th of what we're consuming. In 10 years from now, it won't be 1/20th. It'll be 1/21st, 1/22nd, 1/23rd, because our consumption will have gone up. So the message that I hope you hear from me is please don't count on AMWAR. And one of the problems you have in Congress is that you pass a piece of legislation, everybody says, oh, fix that. Problem solved. If we drill in AMWAR, we've nowhere near solved the problem. Actually, I think it can be done environmentally, in an environmentally safe way. But I've been voting no on drilling in AMWAR because I think that it makes some national security sense to hold on to those reserves for the time when we actually need them. The English, well, you need them now. Did you see the prices? We need it now. Well, oil can be used for a lot of things. Some of them aren't really good uses, like burning it for various things, particularly burning fuels for electric generation is particularly lousy use of hydrocarbons. There are a lot more valuable things to do with it, like make pharmaceuticals, make plastics. And so if we hold on to that oil while the world runs out, we may be in the sweet spot of having it for when pharmaceuticals can't be made out of anything else besides that Alaskan oil. In the near term, let's hope we can do some conservation. And you would think that this, well, I shouldn't say that. I was going to say you would think this is non-controversial, but it does create some controversy, particularly among the auto manufacturers, is why not require higher fuel efficiency? I happen to think that makes sense because, again, it's a national security issue. some sort of laissez-faire kind of libertarian kind of thought would be, well, no, the market will figure that out. The market, that I believe, doesn't necessarily factor in the national security risk that we're currently running when we have this low fuel efficiency that we're living with. Actually, the technology is available to us. We've gotten a lot more fuel efficient. It's just we're driving our living room down the road with us. We got the cooler in there, we got the televisions in there, we got the everything with us. And that's where some of the fuel efficiency is gone, is we're carrying more weight down the road. So in the near term, surely we can do some conservation, and that would help us. That's the most immediate thing we can do to fix our problem. Second, in the midterm, hybrid vehicles surely make a lot of sense. The ethanol and methanol options make a lot of sense. Biodiesel, these are things that South Carolina actually can have a future in, because there's some hope that we're going to have a better method of digesting cellulose. And so it may be that we're going to be making ethanol out of wood chips and slashings off of pine trees in the low country. Anything that you can rot and make white lightning out of, and we know a thing or two about making white lightning, particularly in my neighborhood in northern Greenville County. We know about making white lightning up there. In fact, I understand what you do is you put a squirrel in the, you add dead things into the mash, and it just sort of all rots faster. Well, we've found some ways to make it rot faster. Interesting enough, National Science Foundation is working on an enzyme out of the stomach of goats that allows the goat to digest wood. And the result is that, particularly if we can genetically engineer it to make it super duper fast in that process, we may end up with a very economical way, hopefully, of making ethanol from stuff here in South Carolina. Right now, the ethanol out in the Midwest, big debate about whether it makes sense to make ethanol out of corn, Some people love it. Some people say, no, look at the energy inputs you got to get it to put in there to get it out. Well, we got to have some breakthroughs there, and hopefully this digesting cellulose might help us. In the long term, what I hope we do is transition to a hydrogen economy. One of the first questions people ask is, I can't quite see it at their top, but is hydrogen safe? Anybody here remember the Hindenburg? That's what people usually say. Who wants to drive around a hydrogen car and beat another Hindenburg? I haven't looked at the footage of the burning of the Hindenburg, but what I understand is that you can actually see when the hydrogen started to burn, and it saved lives. Because what happened is the flame all of a sudden starts going straight up. That's when the hydrogen ignited. Up until then, what was burning apparently was the canvas cover and especially the jet aviation fuel that they had coated it with. That was on fire. Then the hydrogen burned and burned straight up. The two cars on fire here show that. Actually, the picture on the left is some sort of an infrared picture because you wouldn't be able to see that fire. That's one of the challenges of hydrogen, is that when it burns, you can't see it. But it's burning very, very hot. The car on the right is a gasoline fire. The difference is that when gasoline comes out of your tank and gets underneath your car, the whole thing catches on fire. Whereas in a hydrogen fire, it escapes straight up, burns very quickly, very intensely, and then it's all done. Now, of course, if you're sitting atop the hydrogen tank, it's not a good day. But as long as you're in the vehicle and not on the tank, you're all right. Something to think about a fun fact to tell your friends when they ask, is hydrogen safe? Why hydrogen? Well, it's very abundant. It's the world's most common element, as you know, and it's also very clean. We try to show that down there at the bottom. Those are water bubbles, I suppose. Because if we can make it happen, if you drive down the road using hydrogen, the emission is water out of your car, whether it's an internal combustion engine which BMW is making or a fuel cell which General Motors is doing. So what do we need to get there? We need, the top can't see it, but commitment, collaboration, and discovery. The commitment, by the way, next slide there, Price, is... I think this kind of commitment that some of you might remember President Kennedy saying that we need to go to the moon take a man to the moon and return him safely before the decade is out. We actually did it. He said it to the Congress on May the 25th, 1961, and Neil Armstrong on July 20th, 1969. America accomplished it. I think that's the kind of commitment we need to have to this current task. It also takes collaboration, a lot of collaboration across the country. It might not be great or a big surprise here to hear that there are 49 other states that think that they are the perfect place to do this research on hydrogen. I happen to think that South Carolina is one of those because of some assets we've got. One of them is the Clemson ICAR, International Center for Automotive Research. BMW now gave $10 million of cash to Clemson, diverted $40 million worth of state incentives, so they're in it for $50 million. Michelin is in it for $3 million. IBM and Microsoft are participating there. You might have read about it in the Herald Journal recently. Jason Spencer did a very good article about it. So we've got Clemson ICAR, which is mostly here because of BMW. BMW intends to lead the hydrogen revolution. They will have a car within a couple years released in Germany that runs both gasoline and hydrogen in the same internal combustion engine. So you have two tanks. The fuel comes in, is exploded in the cylinder just like the car that you drove in to get here. When you got hydrogen, run hydrogen. When you don't, run gasoline. General Motors has a different technology. It's basically a fuel cell that runs hydrogen through what is essentially a battery and splits the electron off and creates electricity. The electricity would run electric motors that run your car's wheels. So we have Clemson ICAR. We have the Center for Fuel Cell Research at USC. And then bottom right down there, the Jim Clyburn Center of Transportation at South Carolina State. And probably our biggest asset is the Savannah River National Lab, which for 50 years, Savannah River site, has been doing work on tritium. Tritium is a radioactive isotope of hydrogen. It's essentially the task that we've been doing there is storing hydrogen. And we've had a real incentive to do that in South Carolina because our hydrogen down there is radioactive. If we didn't keep it under pressure, the whole state would be glowing. So we've been doing that for 50 years. And next slide you see is the discoveries that we need. One of the key discoveries ties in exactly with the proficiencies of Savannah River site, and that is how to store hydrogen. Right now we can go about 100 miles in a fuel cell. We need to go 300 miles for market acceptance because you're not used to visiting at Wilton stations except every 300 miles. You don't want to come by more often than every 300 miles. That's one of the challenges. So we need to figure out a way to store it. We also need to get the fuel cell cost down. Right now, the catalyst on the membrane on a fuel cell is made out of platinum. You might be wearing platinum just a little teeny bit somewhere on a ring or something, and you know it's very expensive. So we can't exactly make millions of cars with platinum membranes in them. So we need a breakthrough there. Clemson is working on that. And then we also need to figure out a way to make hydrogen cost effectively. Probably the most effective way to make it currently is through nuclear power. You got to get comfortable with nuclear. Some people aren't. I am. And it's very interesting to see, I was in Congress for 6 years, 93 to 98, then gone 6 years, now back. It's interesting to see how environmentalists have sort of come around on this issue of nuclear power. Because the problem with nuclear power is you've got waste at the end of the day or the end of the fuel cycle, but you don't have any emissions. You don't have any carbon that you've just released. In California right now, they're producing 55% of their electricity from natural gas, which is just a disaster for the environment. Because that means that all of that carbon is going up, being burned into the air in California. Whereas if they would take some of the mothballs out of the nuclear power plants, they've literally got one in mothballs out there, they could produce power with no emissions. Now, you've got to figure out something to do with the waste, and that is a big problem. But I would submit to you it's not as big a problem as the CO2 issue. and it's interesting to see environmentalists coming around on that. Let me stop there and see if you have questions about or comments about energy alternatives. And like I said earlier, if you want to switch to another topic, we can do that as soon as you get tired of this one. Yes, sir.
Why don't you talk about coal? We have an incredible amount of resources in this country in coal. Process, say, Germany that allows us to take coal and make it into gas.
Yeah.
And it's not, it's cost efficient given the current price of a gallon of gas.
Right. Coal is very abundant in this country. And that's exactly right. We've got technologies that make it possible to turn it into gas. It's been around for a while. We've made them even better over on Garlington Road, and Greenville General Electric has real proficiencies in generators that can burn coal very cleanly. Long term, the problem with coal is the same problem as any other hydrocarbon, that is, you're emitting CO2.
You can take the CO2 and pump it down to the ground and replace the gasoline that you are, the oil that you've taken out of it to make gasoline.
That's true. There's some thought we can sequester the CO2. It's not real clear exactly how that's going to work, but if there's a breakthrough there.
Working in Canada right now.
To pump the oil shale out, yeah. It certainly is one of the options out there, and I would include it in some of those midterm solutions. The reason I'm so intent on hydrogen being a long-term solution is you get this beautiful thing of water as your emission, which is a very nice thing. And it also makes it so that you have a stable supply here in our own country and elsewhere. Jack?
Speaking to the hydrogen idea, what is the collective view of the Congress that you serve in, Bob? How do they feel about this as an alternative fuel source?
Great question. I had a meeting the other day with the president. It was nice to have a group of people down at the White House. I think the idea was to get about 15 of us that are very excited about it, Republicans and Democrats, together with three key committee chairmen who needed some enthusiasm, needed it to rub off on them. The only problem is the 15 or so of us that are very excited about it don't have chairman in front of our name. Well, actually, I do, but it's a chairman of a subcommittee at research at science. But the three were chairman of big committees. One of them was energy and commerce. That's a key committee. The only challenge here is the fellows from Texas. It was the maturation of Bob Inglis. At 9 o'clock in the morning, I was telling Al Hubbard, who's the president's domestic policy advisor, very boldly, Al, what you need the president to do is go out there and say we're going to eliminate all earmarks in the hydrogen area, and we're going to spend the money as the scientists say to spend at the Department of Energy. And that's what we need to do. That's what I was telling them at 9 o'clock. At 3 o'clock down at the White House, I was coming to understand some of the other issues about having these Texans that were there. And in fact, the president said, you know, you wouldn't expect a Texan to be interested in alternative energy. And then he went on to say something very interesting. He said, when I came into office in 2001, oil was $15 a barrel. And I wasn't interested at all in alternative energy. He said, oil is now $65 a barrel, and I am very interested in alternative energy. That was the message that he was trying to pass on to those three committee chairmen, and the rest of us were there to sort of, you know, say, yeah, he's right, listen to him. And I think we did that pretty well. but we got to overcome some entrenched interest. There are some entrenched interest out there that either poo-poo our problem, say that it's not a problem, we're going to find out something else, or that they got a lot of reserves in the ground and they want to sell those reserves. That's a challenge for us. Yes, sir.
You mentioned the opposition of the environmentalists to the
Are
the oil interests also opposing this? Are they a factor in the opposition or not?
Well, oil is, it depends on who you are in the oil business. If you're ExxonMobil, you got the largest reserves in the world, and you're not too interested, but they did suffer coming to Savannah Riverside with me 2 weeks ago. I got them to come down after really sort of pushing and badgering them. Every once in a while, people say the words excess profits taxes, and it causes them to perk up. ExxonMobil perks up and pays attention then. And so they came down to see Savannah Riverside, and the idea was to show them, if you want to get in this commodity business of the future, here's a partner for you that can help you with the storage issues. That was my goal in bringing them here. They were nice to suffer that presentation. There's some others that are more interested in the presentation. BP and Royal Dutch Shell, they have fewer reserves, so they're much more interested. Where you sit determines where you stand, you know, not just in politics, but in business. And if you've got large reserves, no need to do anything. If you're a Royal Dutch Shell and don't have such large reserves, you want to do something. So hopefully they're going to see the opportunity to not be the railroad companies of the 1800s. You know, the railroad company, or 1900s, railroad companies could have become the airlines, but they said, nobody's going to fly. And so they just kept doing rail. They had the capital to do it. They had the capital to become the transportation company, you know, that does to take you by rail or take you by plane. They passed up the opportunity. We're hoping to convince the oil companies that here's your chance. You're the railroad. What are you going to do? Are you going to switch to a new commodity and continue to make lots of money, which we would say, bless you, we love it when people make money. Or are you going to become the railroads that passed up the opportunity to form airlines? Yes, Art.
Bob, is there any use of the radioactive waste that we're storing? Is there anything we can turn that into positive rather than a negative?
Yeah, at Science Committee, we had a hearing on reprocessing, which you remember Jimmy Carter said we wouldn't do in 1977 or 8 or somewhere along in there. The rest of the world proceeded with reprocessing, did it a lot in Germany, France, and we made it all the different decision. There's some possibility that we could reprocess some of that spent fuel. One of the drawbacks is it produces plutonium, and you got to guard that pretty carefully. They've been doing that in a continuous fuel cycle in France, for example. And you know, the interesting thing is there. I imagine you join me in the perception that France is surely more green than the United States. And if they're comfortable with that, then the question is, why aren't we comfortable with it? So we can do that. One thing's for sure, though, is we got to get a permanent repository of spent fuel opened. I hope that's Yucca Mountain, and I hope it's soon, because it's not acceptable to have spent fuel rods over to the Coney Station in the swimming pool out there. It's really just under 5 or 6 feet of water. There, the control rods and the spent fuel rods, waiting to be shipped to a permanent place, permanent home. We need that permanent home. Yes, sir.
Bob, the last few appropriation bills have created publicity with pork barrel that has been in there, whether it's the $250 million bridge to nowhere in Alaska or whatever. Are we any closer to a line item veto?
I think so. The president's asking for one, I signed on a bill to give it to him. I think we might do it, and it would be helpful. Our challenge is that you get going in this business and you get sort of accustomed to the way it is, and that's one of the challenges of this majority right now. I'll tell you is that majorities have to figure out a way to refresh themselves, just like the incumbent leader in any market that's represented here. If you're that top dog in any market, you got to constantly figure out how to reinvigorate your product, right? And stay on top, because otherwise the incumbent supplier gets knocked out eventually. Same with the majorities in Congress. And we really need to think a little bit more clearly about budget matters, because we've spent money like drunken sailors. And by the way, I said that recently to the Herald Journal, and some guy wrote a letter to the editor saying that I should apologize to all sailors out there. I've got the fellow's number. I'm going to call him up and see if I can introduce a little bit of humor to his humorless life. But I'm looking for the opportunity to get on the phone with him. But explain, I wasn't offending sailors. I was actually offending ourselves, the majority in Congress. Who wants to ask the last question? I see we're almost out of time, or maybe you are out of time. Yes, sir.
What's going on with border security, particularly along the southern border, and the incursions, which are, you know, appear to be supported by the Mexican military?
Yeah. It's pretty scary down there with some of the sort of paramilitary kind of things going on related to drugs and that sort of thing. What's going on is the House passed in December two pieces of the solution. We got to get to do a couple more pieces, I think. The two pieces that we passed that are part of the solution are, one is tougher border control, including some fences. Second, we made a requirement that employers check Social Security numbers before giving jobs. And I'm looking at employers, you're probably thinking, wait, you're going to put another requirement on? Well, it's an 800 number, and it's a quick check online. It won't take you much time. But it will turn off the magnet of people wanting to come here. Because if the word gets out in Nicaragua, no reason to go there, because when you get there, you can't get a job if you don't have a valid Social Security number. It really would turn off the magnet, I believe. You've got to do two other things, in my opinion. One is figure out where we need to have a temporary worker kind of program. There are apparently some jobs, particularly a lot of agricultural kind of things, where we need an effective program of bringing people in and allowing them to return home. What we have right now is you come across the border and you don't want to go back because you've paid the coyote $5,000 to get here, so you're not going to go back because all of your capital is spent now. You used up your $5,000 capital in El Salvador or wherever, and you're now penniless. So you're going to stay here. If we had a temporary worker program, perhaps they could cycle back and forth across the border doing the jobs that Americans won't fill. We could have a big discussion about whether there is such a job. Fourth thing I think we need to do that I hope I can get a little head nodding here, but I don't know how many heads I'll get nodding, because most of the time I find that almost nobody likes this idea. But we need to increase the numbers of legal immigrants. We've actually got a very restrictive policy in this country. We only let in 500,000 people last year, legally. The heyday of Ellis Island, we were letting in 1.1 million in some years to a much smaller country. We got 290 million people now. We only let in 500,000 people last year. So we got enormous pressure on getting here. And actually, we want people to come here. We want this student to come back. We'd like for him to come to Clemson or come to USC. Come to USC Upstate, and then decide after getting educated here to stay here, because we want the best and the brightest here. But like I say, not many people are really excited about that, but I think it is an important part of what we need to do in order to fix the problem. Kurt?
How many in Congress realize that if we would get rid of all the illegal immigrants, we would shut down the whole economy? And you go.